Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with LS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, we're lacing up our Nike Air Mags, jumping in the DeLorean and going back to the future. We're looking at your older self, encourage you to save more. Should you switch your motor to an electric now? Can we ever keep pace with the hackers? And get out the mini violins. We talk inheritance tax problems of the biggest winners from the property price boom. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, rather a champagne problem, but one that could affect ordinary people. Now, you have a reader, Simon, living with and raising his son in his childhood home, which I imagine there's quite a few people doing that. Now, his parents, in their 70s, also live there as well. But the issue here is that the property was bought in a very central part of London back in the 70s and would now be worth many millions of pounds. So how can they make sure that they aren't turfed out due to inheritance tax? I think is essentially the nub of the issue rather than the fact they're now in a multi-million pound property, which I imagine most people won't find themselves in that particular situation, but may find themselves in a situation of being turfed out of their home.
Yes, this is not a problem that many people will share. However, it won't be unique in London and the South East. We are talking about a scenario where there is a generation of homeowners in their 60s, their 70s, who could have bought houses as relatively ordinary individuals. They would have been comfortable in life in order to buy those properties, but they wouldn't have been considered particularly rich if they'd bought them in the 70s and the early 80s. And then what has happened is a combination of astronomic house price inflation, gentrification of certain areas, the limited availability of properties to purchase has seen house prices in some of those areas go absolutely stratospheric. I mean, for example, to take a place up the road from where we work in High Street, Kensington, if you go up to Notting Hill, you could have bought one of those big 3-4 story townhouses for maybe £500,000-£600,000 at some point in the 1990s, You would now own a house that is probably worth £7 million. So it's we don't know how much this particular house is worth, but the reader who wrote in said high single digit millions. So we are talking nearly £10 million. Now, in theory, if your family owns such a property, a £10 million property, or even if you go outside of London to the commuter belt, perhaps to places like St Albans, Radlett, Harpenden, Weybridge, it might be a £2 million property. But whilst in theory you benefit from this, other than having a nice feeling that your house is worth lots of money, and there's a certain amount of comfort that comes from the fact that your mortgage is either minuscule compared to the outsized value of your house, or actually you paid off your mortgage long ago and you've got an asset worth a couple of million pounds, there is no real benefit from that property unless you basically either do two things: move out, which lots of these people don't want to do because it's their family home and they want to live in that area, they like their community, they like their family home, or you load up on debt, take out a big mortgage against it and then start spending the money. So really the benefit comes from those properties for these families. And the important thing about this is a question for someone who's thinking as a family. Ultimately, the benefit comes from these expensive houses in terms of inheritance. But if it's your home and you want to stay living there, or it's your family home and you think, well, you know what I'd really like to do is I don't want to sell that house. I don't want the millions of pounds. I'd like to move into it. I want it to continue to be our family home, to continue living in this community. Ultimately, you could lose it due to inheritance tax, because inheritance tax is 40%. Everybody has an allowance of £325,000. A married couple can double that up to £650,000. There is a new main residence allowance that is being filtered in, which will cover people who have a family home that is passed to a direct descendant, up, meaning they can pass on £1 million tax-free. But once your estate goes above £2 million, you start having that taken off you. So once you get to £2.7 million, you've lost it completely and you're back down to £650. Now, if you're in the position of having a house that's worth high single-digit millions, you're going to have £650,000 of it that is inheritance tax-free, and the rest of it is going to have a tax charge on it. So you could be looking at a tax charge of £3.5 million. Now, the only way you're going to be able to pay that tax charge is by selling the house, because unless you've got £3.5 million in your back pocket, or you can't even mortgage the house for £3.5 million to pay it because you can't afford the repayments on the mortgage.
Yeah. Well, and we should point out as well that the reader said that they were pretty cash poor. Look, Lee, and I'll get into the more detail, Simon, in a second, but Lee, I like my family home, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I like the community. But I tell you what, I'd like 10 million as well.
I know what you're saying, Georgie. That figure on a piece of paper looks mighty impressive. And actually, I often walk through parts of London and look at some of these big properties and think, I wonder who lives in these. I wonder who owns them. And I wonder if some of this has, you know, gone down the generations a little bit, and people like to stay in the community and in their family home. And actually, in this question, I read it, and I thought about the whole little tiny violin. And then I read it again and thought, actually, there's going to be people that are really sort of affected by this. They want to stay in this family home. They've grown up in it. They want their child to grow up in it. And it's not their fault, really, that they've bought a property which then, you know, has snowballed out of control value-wise. They're not really in it for the value, really. Mm. They wanted to stay living there. That's the vibe I get from the question. But you're right. I mean, that figure in your back pocket, you think, God, imagine where you could sort of move out to and how much you could have left over and everything. But I think it's very nice that someone wants to stay in the community, and that's where they grew up. It's probably got some good schools. They've got the friends there. They've got their network there. They probably work close by. Everything works for them. They don't want to be moving out and having to deal with all of that.
And also, if you're in your 70s, I mean, the parents as well, do you really want to be uprooting your whole life you've spent in that area? So I can certainly understand that.
Exactly that. And actually, Georgian, I've made no secret of this. I'm not actually a huge fan of inheritance tax. It's never been anything that's affected me or my family or anything like that. But I always feel like it's a little bit of a tax on being successful, basically. So what is the incentive to, you know, be successful and earn money for yourself and get a good career if at the end of the day you get towards...
But then the argument with this is there is no success in this apart from they lucked out in the 70s and the property price boom, they're one of the winners.
Yeah, and that, you know, this is a bit of a different case to someone that's actually, you know, gone through their career and managed to earn quite a lot of money doing being successful in whatever it is that they do. But even still, I mean, they bought this house and they've used it as a family home. It's not like they've used it as some sort of cash chip and they're using it to take wealth from. It's just where they live. It just happens to be where they live and they want to stay living there. And I think actually it's quite galling to think that you could end up having a £3 million tax bill. That doesn't feel incredibly fair to me. And as the question says, they're not exactly cash rich. Mm. So I think it's a tad unfair. I think some of these rules need to be looked at a little bit, in my opinion.
They'd still be left with about £6 or 7 million, though, let's be honest, if they sold it. But I take your point. Simon, at which point do you have to pay this? Because wouldn't it make more sense in situations like this that you basically defer the payment until you're ready to sell the place? So you can stay in your family home, because there'll be lots of people in this situation, not with 10 million homes, but that, you know, need or want to stay in that family home. Can they not defer it?
No, you have to settle the bill at the point when you're dealing with probate. So actually you find situations where people have to settle that bill before they can finalise the probate process. And that means that people without multi-million pound houses, people with smaller estates but who are getting hit by inheritance tax, often end up having to take out loans from the bank in order to pay the inheritance tax bill, which then enables them to get their hands on the estate and deal with the estate so they can then get the money to pay the loan back to the bank. So yes, there is a great argument for a much better ability to defer this. Going back to what you said, though, you know, they're still going to end up £6 million kind of thing. I think what's really interesting here is, and you know, the tiny violins and all that, but if this family are living in a part of London where a house is worth high single-digit millions, they are probably one of the last ordinary families living on their street, one of the few ordinary families still living in that area. Now, what's going to happen as the owners of these houses die out and people actually hit this kind of problem is those last few ordinary families are going to be chased out of the area by tax, and someone who works in an investment bank or the city or a fund manager or is a partner in a law firm is going to move in with their family, and you're going to see the final remaining slightly ordinary families replaced by people who are earning multi-million pounds a year. I do think that that's quite a sad situation to see, actually. And there's a solution. You could, for example, keep the property, but instead of keeping the whole house, you divide it in two and you sell off half of it as a flat that then hopefully pays for it. But then you'd be feeling, well, why do I have to do this to my family home of 40 years? And we suddenly have to go into living in half of it.
And it may not be that big, let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine the scenario where, for example, if I was the only person to inherit, and I inherited my mum's house, for example, and I'd think, you know what, I'd like to move in there with my family, but the only way I could move in there with my family would be by hiving half of it off and selling it to someone. I'd feel very upset about that. Anyway,
what's the advice?
The good news is that there is a way of dealing with this.
Okay.
So the advice that we've got here is from Stuart Thorne, a trust and estates practitioner who specialises in lifetime tax planning and succession issues of Clark Wilmot LLP. So that's his credentials. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he said, let's assume for the sake of calculation, the house is mortgage free and worth, say, 8.65 million. OK, so high single digits. If your parents do nothing, they have nil rate bands totaling £650,000, as we discussed before, but they don't have any main residence nil rate band because they're worth more than 2.7 million. As we discussed, that gets taken off you. Inheritance tax from the estate would therefore currently be £3.2 million. £3.2 million! Now, he said some financial advisors might suggest things like leaving things alone, taking out equity release, taking out some kind of expensive whole of life insurance policy, which would be very expensive for that kind of money. But he said the simple answer is for your parents to make a gift, a substantial share to you and or your son as soon as possible. Then provided they survive the gift by 7 years and they don't fall foul of some special rules called reservation of benefit, that I'll explain in a minute, the value gifted would fall outside of the taxable estate. So he said, if four of you are living there, it would be reasonable to give a 50% share. Or he said, if you've got a partner there too, 60%. Giving away a share of the house then devalues the retained share. So if you give away half of your house and you no longer own half of it, your half of it becomes worth less because it's harder to sell. So he said probably by about 12%, but he said HMRC will easily accept 10%. So that would take it down 10%. If you give 50%, live 7 years, the retained element would be worth 3.8 million if prices don't go up in the meantime. Inheritance tax bill would fall from 3.2 million to 1.26 million. Starts becoming more achievable, but then I think about how many people have got 1.26 million in readies? Not that many. But he said you could minimise the tax bill still more efficiently. He said HMRC wouldn't be impressed if you tried to gift 99% of the property. But provided occupation remains genuinely shared, i.e. the parents still live there, you live there, the son lives there, and the donees don't end up paying more than their proportionate share of household outgoings, so they're not picking up all the bills. So it doesn't look like they're deliberately giving away a big chunk of the house and then still living there and still benefiting from it, then a gift of 75% would probably be accepted. And there'd be no need for a rental payment to avoid reservation of benefit. So to explain this reservation of benefit thing, the reason why you can't just give away your house to your kids early and then hope that you survive 7 years, or if you don't survive 7 years, it tapers down so you don't get hit by the full 40%, is because you can't still continue to live there. If you do continue to live there, you have to be seen not to be benefiting, deriving a benefit from it. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you have to pay market rent. So you're going to have to pay market rent to your kids, which for some people is possible, but for most people is impossible. And you also have to pay your bills. Now, if you're sharing the house and you're living there with someone and then you give them the half, you've got another slight problem, which is if it looks like you're still living there and paying all the bills, but you've just given them half of the house, that still looks like it's your house. So you have to be very careful that this looks exactly right to the tax man. Anyway, he said, if you give away the 75%, the retained share with the discount would be worth around 1.9 million. That then pushes it back below that 2 million barrier. You benefit from the main residence nil rate band. The final inheritance tax bill then, if house prices don't rise in the meantime, would be down to a much more palatable £220,000 So that's a saving of almost $3 million. So he said, assuming your parents have a good medical report, it'd be well worth investigating the cost of suitable structured seven-year term life insurance to cover potential inheritance tax. So you take out life insurance that just covers those 7 years, and you know after those 7 years there won't be any to pay. That might be surprisingly affordable. There's some other advantages. But he said, final advice, get on with it and start the seven-year clock ticking. Now, there is one colossal caveat that I would add to this, and his name is Jeremy Corbyn. Now, there is a very strong chance that if we get a Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell government, the inheritance tax rules will change. They've already said that they would remove that main residence nil rate band. Who knows whether they might do something to that seven-year rule. There's even the government at the moment are looking at inheritance tax. Now, the thing is, tax changes are not meant to be backward-looking. They're only meant to be forward-looking. So if anybody has given away money already, they should still benefit from that seven-year rule. But who knows? We've seen lots of things happen in recent years where they haven't respected the previous tax code and done these things. So it might be that this doesn't work, but at least you'd be trying to do something.
Well, given we're looking at the future as well, I'm still waiting for the 18% drop in house prices, so that might help as well.
Ironically, this family would benefit hugely from house prices halving.
There you go then, exactly. We're going to stick on this subject because what if you've been put in charge of someone else's inheritance? So taking on the role of trustee, big responsibility. You want to make sure that you make the right financial decisions. So, Lee, if you would just tell us about your next reader who has this particular issue with, I believe, their younger sister.
That's correct, yes. So, been given £50,000 to look after, been holding on to the money for 2 years for when the sister turns 25. So, it's an 18 to 25 trust. That person will get their money on the 25th birthday. Now, this is actually a really interesting question because I think this happens probably quite a lot. And this person's been put in charge of this pot of cash. And it's that kind of deliberation over what you should do with the money, because you don't want to be too risky with it. You know, yeah. You don't want to start thinking or putting it into, you know, things that are high risk. There may be high returns, but you don't want that money to start disappearing and be lower than it was when you were given the money. But at the same time, a lot of people probably do what this reader's done and stuck it in a savings account. And this savings account at the moment is paying 0.25% interest. Now, that's no good either. Not when inflation is 2.5%. Mm. I mean, that's not a good move. And they're holding on to this money for the next sort of 5.5 years. You know, you want some growth from that money. So it's finding the balance in between those two things, from the extreme to really low returns where this money is currently being held. Now, actually, what I found really interesting about this is actually the Trustee Act 2000. I didn't really actually know an awful lot about this, and it's
why not, Lee? I read it at bedtime.
Well, this is it. I should have done. I should have printed that act off and had a read. But actually, Section 1 of the Act. Actually, I love it when Section 1 of the Act actually just outlines the most important bit. Is a trustee must exercise such care and skill as is reasonable in the circumstances. So basically that means that you can't be reckless with that money. And if you are, or something happens to that pot of money and the person that you've been looking after the money for turns around and is not happy with what you've done with that money in the past. And it does happen.
Leaves the door pretty wide open, though, because who deems what to be reckless?
Well, this is it. And actually, the advice in here is to get some financial advice. So you have some sort of recourse to say, well, look, I went to this advisor and this is what they suggested. And the onus is on them if it hasn't performed how it's performed. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's lots of advice out there. As Simon always says, 5 years usually is the bare minimum to be looking at in long-term investment. So 5.5 years might be enough time to think about some solid growth. Doesn't have to be anything, you know, over the top. It could just be a cautious mix of various things that we outline in this story, actually. What could make up a good portfolio for someone like this? So a mix of cash and global and UK equities, some fixed interest bonds, and even some alternatives, sort of like property and private equity. So just having a real think about how you can have a balanced, it's the same with any investing, really, that you have a sort of balanced portfolio. And at the end of the day, it's going to be better probably than putting it in a 0.25% savings account.
Yeah, one issue with this, though, is financial advice, Simon, costs money. So should you as the trustee be paying for that, or can you take it out of this fund?
No, you can take it out of the fund, but there's a very interesting thing here as well. Mm-hmm. So when I was editing this story the other day, I looked into this advice thing, and we've published this in the article. Whilst it says that the trustee should take advice, it doesn't specifically say paid for financial advice or professional financial advice. And in fact, it looks like it's deliberately slightly grey on that. So it also indicates that someone with suitable expertise would also be a reasonable person to ask. So, for example, if you were to ask, if you had another relative or a friend who had been investing throughout, who was a DIY investor, had been investing throughout their entire life, it would imply that they would count. If you knew someone, for example, particularly if they had some form of professional element to their job that meant, you know, they were an investor, they were also an accountant or something like that. It also talks about, for example, if you were going to invest in property or something like that. But then even then, it doesn't say a property professional. It doesn't say you have to ask an estate agent or a surveyor. So I think what it's saying in the Act is you've got a duty of care and responsibility. And if you don't know what you're doing and you can't justify that you know what you're doing, you should seek the advice of someone who is qualified to do that, but not as in an official qualification or necessarily paid for. Now, for most people, the best person to seek advice from would be a paid for financial advisor, but it doesn't say that it has to be.
Just not the bloke down the pub.
Not the bloke down the pub. What, Barry, who's in that betting scheme, makes all that money?
That's just the one.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Now, looking to our own futures, how would you rate your retirement saving? The good news is that Scottish Widows' latest retirement report shows 55% of us are doing a pretty good job. But there's always a but, isn't there? Almost one in five workers aren't saving anything. Now, a team of pension experts are touring the nation, offering free pension guidance to everyone in a big bus. No spurious claims on the side, I hope, of this one. Robert Cochran, retirement expert at Scottish Widows, says the message is getting through, but more needs to be done.
We've seen 10 million people automatically enrolled into a pension scheme over the last 4 or 5 years. We now find that 83% of UK workers are saving into some kind of a pension. And by next year, the contribution rate will get to about 8%. So awareness is getting there. And I guess in some ways, we've used a bit of behavioural psychology to take away the requirement for awareness and just automatically put people into the pensions. We run a pension awareness tour. And what we do find is that a lot of the happiest people we see are older people who come along, who've got a guaranteed income for life. But what was amazing is a lot of these people didn't know that they'd even been put into a pension scheme when they were working. So they were just put in a pension scheme, they've retired, they've got a fixed income. For younger people, they're not going to look forward to that, what we call a golden pension, a defined benefit scheme in the future. But auto-enrolment is helping them by putting them into the pension scheme. So I think where we see the bigger challenge is actually people in their late 30s, 40s, who didn't get the final salary scheme and also are being auto-enrolled into pension much later, so won't get the full benefit of 40 or so years of being in a scheme where their employer's been contributing. When automatic enrolment came along, people were saying, you know, in reasonably large numbers that they wouldn't remain in the pension scheme. But in actual fact, they have remained in. So you found that less than 1 in 10 people have actually opted out of the pension scheme. Although they said they wouldn't remain in it, they have actually remained in. And this year, they've seen their contributions increase. The minimum contributions have gone up significantly from 1% to 3%. Yet still, the opt-out rate has remained very, very small. So there's a perception that people can't afford it, but if it's done in a way whereby it just happens automatically, you're finding that people can adjust to save for their own retirement. One of my favourite things we've taken out to employers quite a lot is an age me game. So how that works is it says to whoever it is that comes up to, come up, let's take a photograph of you just now and let's age you to the age at which you can retire at. So our report says that people want to retire on £24,000 a year. Now you'll get a roughly £8,000 estate pension, which leaves you a £16,000 shortfall. So then what it'll do is say, how much have you got in your pension fund? And if you don't know, well, you know what, that's an opportunity for you to go and find out how much you've got in. And if you don't know how much is going in, again, an opportunity for you to find out how much you've got going in. And then it ages you to the age at which you'll be able to get an income of £24,000 a year. I had two colleagues doing exactly the same job join the bus this week. They stood next to each other. One of them had been in a pension scheme for 17 years, and she was aged to 62. as the age at which she could take her benefits. Her colleague had opted out of the pension scheme 6 years ago, so she had missed out on 6 years of pension contributions, and she was aged to 100 plus. So you can imagine the shock in her face when she saw herself going from early 30s to 100 plus. It's that wake-up call. It's that helping people imagine and vision their own future.
So Lee Roberts' concern was those people late 30s, and I appreciate you're not quite in your late 30s yet, but you know, predominantly the people in this room are the ones that are going to be perhaps struggling the most. Do you agree with that?
I can totally see the logic behind that, because first of all, if you're in your late 30s, early 40s, the likelihood is you've probably got onto the property ladder more so than the generation that's preceded it. So it means that a lot of people look at their property and go, well, that was the most important thing, and I've got the property and I'm making the mortgage payments, and pensions kind of come second fiddle to that. I think from about 30 under, everyone's kind of now auto-enrolled, which has really helped actually bring pensions to the forefront of people's minds, and actually realised that having a pension is going to be pretty vital, especially with question marks over the future of state pension and what that could look like in future years. So there's that. And also, it's harder to make up for lost time. So if you are 40 rather than 30 and you haven't got much of a pension, that's 10 years of having to make up in a short space of time, you know, a sizable pot that's going to be big enough for you to live on when you reach sort of your late 60s. It's not to say it's too late. And if you are in that situation, it's all about maximising it as much as you can, because at the end of the day, there's a mountain of tax relief on that. Lots of workplaces will match what you put in or even double what you put in. You know, so it's well worth doing. The way I see it is it's free money from your employer. So why wouldn't you sort of look into it and maximise it? And the earlier you can get it done, the better. And the thing is, it's easier said than done, because when you start putting, let's say that you pay in 3% of your wage into your pension, to nudge that up by a percent, some people might think, oh, you know, I can't really stretch to do that, and you've got other financial commitments, and it's not as easy as going, well, you know what, I think I'm just going to whack this up to full scale. It's never as easy as that. But
Robert says the point of auto-enrolment is it's probably proved to a lot of people who initially said that they would opt out that actually can be done.
Exactly, it's true. And sometimes when it gets taken out of your pay packet like that, you don't miss it because you didn't ever get it in the first place. And also, I think it's one of those things, we're at a time in the last 5 years in which savings rates have been so incredibly low that I have lots of people in their sort of late 20s, early 30s who are starting to have more earning power where they've had a job for a number of years. You know, they've come out of university, they've had debts to pay off, they've had financial commitments to meet. They get to sort of late 20s, early 30s, they're starting to see a little bit of surplus cash, perhaps where they've you know, had a promotion at work and all that sort of thing. They'll go to me, Lee, I've got this amount of money to save per month. What's the best rate I can get? It's a question I get asked all of the time. And I'll say, if you're looking at a savings account, it's probably going to be 1 to 1.5%. Well, how much interest is that going to get me over the year? And when you say it's a couple of quid, you know, you could just see people going, oh, what's the point of that? You know, absolutely no point. But with a pension, it's completely different. And that's the way I think people have to look at it. And you don't even have to do anything with the money as you get paid. You don't have to move it into another account. It's just coming straight out of your wage into your pension. I actually think auto-enrolment, as the years go on, it actually seems like it's been a very good move. It's got people actually thinking about their pension, thinking about their retirement.
But the point of it is to not have to think about it.
But it's true. But I still think it has made people think, well, actually, this money's getting diverted here. So what am I invested? Where is this money going? And then when you get your annual pension statement through and you see that you haven't seen that money really leave, it's just come out of your wage. And then you see that built up over a year. Perhaps if you're invested in some good funds or whatnot, it's gone up 5%, maybe it's gone up 10%. And then every year that happens and you're adding more and more to it and it starts really snowballing out of control. It is a better way to save for your future than putting money into a savings account. Now, of course, savings account is more of a short term. You're going to want that and you're probably going to save up for something specific. But everyone I sort of speak to at the moment, the two things I say is just make sure that you are maxing out as much as you possibly can on a pension. And I know we say this all the time, but if you have a mortgage, just overpay the mortgage as much as possible. I think it's a better bet than some of these savings accounts that are around.
Simon?
Yeah, great advice from Lee there. I mean, the things I would say is take the money, you put some money in, your employer will contribute some money, and you get the tax relief that, as a basic rate taxpayer, lifts up what you put in by 25%. Start early. Because if you save for 40 years compared to 30 years, you'll double your money due to the magic of compounding. And if you can't start early, start now, okay? Just because you didn't start in your 20s, basically it's better to start in your late 30s than just leave it and start in your late 40s or panic in your 50s. Keep it rising. So you pay a percentage of your salary in, and as your salary goes up, it keeps going up because it's a percentage of your salary.
Most of them offer a box you can tick.
Yes, exactly. That's easy. The law of this is made very easy for you. Then watch the charges on the pension. You probably don't need to worry about that too much on your work pension because the charges shouldn't be too high. Mm. But do look into them because you can't control performance. You can't control how the stock market's going to do over your investing career and your work career. But you can control the charges. So keep an eye on that and keep an eye on how your investments are doing. Most people will just choose the default option, which is probably like a broad tracker fund. But do keep an eye on what's in there and how things are doing. And finally, lots of people would say, I can't afford 50 quid a month. I can't afford that 50 quid. But if you said to them, if you give me 50 quid and I give you £112.50 back, will you do it? And they'd say, OK, yeah, sounds like a good deal. You put in 50 quid. Tax relief is an extra £12.50. Your employer puts in 50 quid. So you can turn 50 quid into £112.50. It's a good deal. Take it. Pay some money into your pension.
It is a very good deal. I do want to ask you just quickly about the fees one, because a lot of people will be looking and think, you know, what's 2% on any investment? You know, that's nothing. But over the long term...
Over 30 or 40 years, it's a lot. So say you imagine you're going to get good average investment returns would be 7% a year on average over that long period. And that is good. Mm. You know, you'd probably be better off thinking more realistically, like a 5 or something like that. But if you get 7 and then you lose 2% of it a year in charges, you end up with a lot less money at the end.
Absolutely. Well worth remembering that. Rightly, talking about the future, crimes of the future, very much now, BA, TV licence, M-Power, just the latest to reveal that they've been victims of hacking, which means that we've been victims of hacking, or their customers have been. We keep talking about going cashlessly, but are we ready when it seems every company is vulnerable to an attack? I have a personal interest in this, given I was away on holiday over the weekend discovering BA issue.
Hey, was you involved in
had
that, Georgie?
Had to cancel my credit card, yep.
Oh dear. Well, yeah, there's been a couple more hacking. It's not banks now. It's not. It's nothing to do with banks. It's more firms that have been exploited this way. Say British Airways, that 380,000 people had their details hacked. We've had TV license company. Over a course of a week, people's details were available to be stolen. We've had M-Power sending out letters to wrong addresses and mixing up customer details. All of these things, Georgie, are technology going wrong. And at the end of the day, is a company like British Airways, the damage that does to the brand is quite significant. You don't want to think that your details are ever going to be compromised wherever you put them. But a big, trusted, global brand like British Airways just goes to show you the vulnerabilities that basically all companies have. And, you know, these forces, they get more and more sophisticated as the years go on. These are gangs of criminals that are dotted around the world that have expertise in this kind of crime.
Can we ever stay one step ahead of them, though, Lee?
Well, this is the thing, Georgie. Personally, as a consumer, as yourself, as long as you're taking... You can only take certain provisions to protect yourself. But when you book a flight with British Airways, you have no option than to put in your card details and to put in details that verify you to make that transaction.
Not just my card details, it's your phone number, it's where you live,
I have gone behind the scenes. I have sat down with an ethical hacker. So this is someone that used to hack as part of a gang, was caught. And then he gave me a sort of rundown a couple of years ago of the dark web, which is a sort of a murky place that sits behind the internet, which anyone can access with the right equipment, and all sorts of dodgy dealings and things go on the dark web. People's data being traded for peanuts, essentially, to then be used for, potential hacking attempts on you as a person. The thing is, for someone like British Airways, they're always going to be a target because of the sheer amount of information that they're processing on a daily basis. If there's any kind of weakness or vulnerability, a hacker is likely to be able to get in there and steal those details and then just flog them on the dark web. And that is just a fact of life now. So for you personally, that's, it's not your fault. You've booked flights with British Airways. You trust them with your information. You're signing up with a contract with them that you trust that they're going to keep your information safe and secure, and then something like this happens and it damages trust. And would you use British Airways again, Georgie?
If I have to, yeah. Do you know, yes,
you never have to.
Well, no, but to a certain extent, yes, because look, every company that I seem to use at the moment has had some sort of an issue. That's the problem with that. It's getting to the stage where this is, I think, the fourth time now I've been hacked in the last 2 years and I've had to cancel a card. You know, wow. Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, across the board. I don't know, maybe I'm just super unlucky. I don't even shop online that much, but honestly, and I should know because I get to sit opposite you, you know, every week telling me what I should be doing. And I did absolutely everything that I could do right. The reality is you are probably going to be a victim at some stage. So obviously, you know, if you have been a victim, then contact Action Fraud, contact your bank immediately. Mm. But for me, the best thing I ever did was downloading my banking app to my mobile phone. They've probably got that as well, to be honest, because that's hacked. But it just means I can check on my
if there's any account suspicious activity.
And I do it every day.
Yeah. Oh, look, that's a good way to be. You have to be vigilant. I mean, that is rule number one, really, when you are trying to stop fraudsters from getting your personal details and you know, doing bad things with them.
What I think is, there's two things I think there. One, the way that the cards and payment system works, particularly in this age of internet shopping where we do business with all kinds of, you know, different people, is it's very difficult to actually work out what is and isn't a fraudulent transaction. Going back to the podcast that you and Lee did about contactless payments and everything the other day, we have so many payments going through our accounts now that little £1, £2, those little testers they do before they defraud you, you wouldn't necessarily be able to spot. And even 30 quid to a name that you don't recognise. Well, there's loads of people that when you buy something off them, it then comes through as something completely different on there. And you have to sit there and think, what did I spend £42 on 2 Tuesdays ago?
Right, so true.
Have I been defrauded?
So true.
And then you remember, I've had it before where I phoned the bank and said, I think this is fraudulent. And they say, well, do you know what it is? And I say, no, I don't know what it is. Do you know what it is? Yeah. And eventually it gets worked out. And you go, no, I haven't been defrauded. Actually, I did spend £42 two Tuesdays ago. The other thing I think is that BA is going to get fined a load of money. Or the suggestion is BA is going to get fined a load of money. That these companies that have been involved in this are going to get fined. Now, the thing is, the fines, I think, to people, they're a little bit, they drift off into the ether. They're not meaningless, but it's just like a large sum of money is going to be taken off the company. It's going to write that off somewhere in its company statement.
Or probably raise fees.
Yeah, it's obviously going to raise its price. If you take money off a company, it will end up costing consumers. Yeah. However, I think we need to get more imaginative with these fines, and we need to make them not necessarily more expensive for them, but something that's a bit more tangible. So, for example, BA should have to refund the cost of the flights to every single person affected. And all those people who booked a flight would go, whoa, got a free flight. Mm-hmm. BA has had to apologise to me by giving me a free flight. Npower, if it's been sending out letters to people with the wrong address, all the people affected should be told you're going to get a month's free energy. What was the other one we mentioned about?
The TV licence.
TV licensing. There you go, a year's free TV.
Yes, free TV.
Yes, free TV.
What about the plan of targeting the CEOs directly?
Yes, or removing their bonuses, especially seeing as a lot of CEOs will be earning a certain level of basic salary and then many multiples of that in bonuses and share options. Yeah, maybe we should take that off them. That would certainly focus the attention on things like this.
I think it might do. All right, well, eventually we will have little to no choice but to own electric cars as we push for an entirely zero emissions road network by 2040. Was the DeLorean, by the way, electric?
No.
Oh, right.
Had lots of electrics in it.
Had a flux capacitor.
But it wasn't electric, though, was it?
Oh, no. Actually, they did have to connect it up to the lightning. That was how they got the power for it. Now, why they had to do that for some reason, because... Oh, no, it ran on uranium. That's why the Libyans came.
Yeah, that's why the Libyans came.
Yeah, that's why the Libyans came, but they couldn't get hold of the uranium back in the 1950s.
So lightning-powered cars, maybe still a way off, but electric cars, that's still a couple of decades away, 2040. But But the transition is well underway. Last month's car sales stats showed electric vehicles secured their highest market share on record. They now make up 4.2% of all new car registrations. But the big question is, have these drivers jumped the gun by making the switch too soon? Or are they benefiting from a financial sweet spot by jumping on the electric car bandwagon now? Lee, what are your views?
Electric cars, Georgie. Until I can drive one from here to Australia and back on one charge, I'm not interested. I'm just joking. It's interesting that the sales of diesels have gone down substantially in the last year, largely thanks to this Dieselgate stuff and all of these changes that are afoot for people that basically penalise anyone that has a diesel car, and that has seen electric car sales sort of rise, and there's been government grants available for a number of years now, but that is on the cusp of ending. So what the argument is that people that have taken advantage of that and bought an electric car using one of those grants have actually done pretty well. But we've got this 2040 deadline. Diesel and petrol cars no longer, in theory, are going to be driven on the roads. If that's reality or not, I mean, it's a long way off, so who knows. But there is obviously now more of an interest in electric cars. And actually, some of this data that Rob Howe, our motoring editor, had a look at here is interesting. There's a number of things that I guess I hadn't really thought about electric cars. And that's one of them is we always go on about the infrastructure not really being quite good enough. And this report sort of highlights that, you know, it is one of the worst for the number of electric cars that are on the roads per charging point isn't great. But a lot of people charge their vehicles at home. They have a way of charging their vehicles at home. So I think at the moment, electric cars, if you're going to get one, it appeals to people that have parking on their driveway and are able to somehow charge their vehicle on their driveway. I think another thing that was actually quite interesting about this as well, that I hadn't really given much thought to, was the number of mechanics that can actually work on electric cars and know the ins and outs and how to repair them is actually quite slim. Most of these are direct. Most of the mechanics are actually directly involved with the manufacturer franchise network. That means there's not actually that many sort of independent mechanics that know how to repair electric cars, which I thought was quite interesting. I'd never really thought about that before. So there's a number of things like that that will have to change for this to become a bigger segment of the market. I mean, it's still a drop in the ocean compared to petrol sales, compared to diesel sales. But, you know, all I can see is this continuing to go up. There was also in this talking about we always sort of talk about this and about how the national grid would cope with all of these cars being charged, which is always one of those sort of things until it really sort of picks up and there's tens and tens and tens of thousands of electric cars on the road, how that would actually work. But there is suggestions that Ofgem might incentivise people to charge electric vehicles outside of peak hours. There's already been that kind of thing in the past for encouraging people to use electricity in obscure hours when people aren't really using it, so you could put your wash on for, you know, cheap at like 3 a.m. in the morning if you could bear the noise. So it's a sort of flexible charging system that would help manage the demand so there wasn't a surge. That's, I think, what a lot of people worry about, that kind of surge in energy use at a particular time, perhaps, you know, 7:30 in the evening after a commute or before a commute. So there's that kind of worrying whether or not that is sustainable, I guess. But the actual cusp of this is just that a full grant subsidy of $4,500 to get an electric car has been pretty good, but these cars are still expensive. So the latest Nissan Leaf is almost $30,000, which is a lot of money considering, you know, it is a car that's been, it was one of the sort of original electric cars, and they've sort of revamped with this new version. But for the same price, you get a high-spec Volkswagen Golf with a petrol engine. So if you had to ask me which one I'd want between the two, I think I know what I'd veer for at the moment.
Simon, I just finally, your views, the big question, have the drivers jumped the gun too soon?
No, because they've been benefiting from this government grant to get electric cars, so that definitely helps out. Once that's removed, you're going to see the cost-benefit thing probably flip back the other way. I don't think that you'd save enough money to make it particularly meaningful unless you were doing a huge amount of miles a year. I sort of looked into this actually from the perspective of someone who was just using one to do around town journeys and things like that. And actually, you don't really save that much over a year. However, I think the key to this is that what we need is more good, low-cost electric cars. So decent electric cars that sell brand new for £20,000 or less. You then need to have trust in second-hand electric cars. This looked at the 4 years of ownership of a brand new electric car. Would you buy a four-year-old electric car? I mean, you're talking about jumping the gun. People worry about the fact that technology is going to keep going up, getting better and better and better and better. We have seen used car prices for things like Renault Zoes, which are small electric cars, jump substantially. But maybe they've jumped from a point where they were depressed a bit lower than they should have been. The worry about range and the thing about home charging is interesting. It said 95% of charging events. So that's not 95% of people charging. It's 95% of the charging that goes on, mm-hmm. done at work or home. So primarily home, I would imagine. People worry about the range. Realistically, a decent electric car, the range is going to be 250 miles. To play it safe, 200 miles. You don't normally drive, most people don't normally drive 200 miles on a regular basis. You do it every so often. But they normally don't drive 200 miles and then drive straight back either. And if you're only doing it every so often, you can plan. And so you don't need the same infrastructure as you've got as petrol stations until you've got loads and loads and loads of people using electric cars. And then you have a problem because you can also drive for 400 miles on a tank of fuel. But you don't see an entire country of empty petrol stations because people don't always drive 400 miles in one go. And then finally, I think workplaces are the key to this, if they've got parking, but also other places people spend time. And the big idea here is supermarkets, whether the supermarkets start installing electric car charging. So people go there, they do their shopping, they charge their car while they're there. Maybe they even get free electricity, and that encourages them to shop at the big Tesco, the big Asda, or so on. But again, it does very much depend on the issue of if you get large numbers of people wanting to do this at the same time, how many charging bays are you going to have? If you think about a big supermarket, it's got a petrol station attached. It's probably got 12 pumps, 15 pumps, but it only takes everybody 5 minutes to fill up their car at those 12, 15 pumps. And it's not like you turn up to those supermarkets and the pumps are all empty, is it? So
that's very true. Well, we'd love to know your views, Simon.
Email us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk, if you've got a question. Tweet us @thisismoney or come to the website on Friday evening. We will publish the podcast article and leave a comment. And you can also keep coming back all over the weekend and the week because the article will still be there. Or to find all of our previous podcasts, go to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
Fantastic. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you do like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.